Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Treathart, part-time film critic, full-time iPhone photographer.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that agrees with the notion that some filmmakers create cinema art that, without question, needs to be seen. What we don't necessarily agree with is exactly whose work should make the must-see list. We'll note how that works out this week as we tackle a trio of films, two of which, at least, were made by directors who rank among today's most admired. The first is 81-year-old Mike Leigh, whose film Hard Truths is another one of his intense studies of real life, this one starring a regular cast member of his, Marianne Jean-Baptiste. Then we'll switch to Presence, a ghost story courtesy of Steven Soderbergh, and we'll end with The Seed of the Sacred Fig, a domestic saga filmed secretly by Iranian writer-director Mohammad Rasalaf. Let's begin by stepping into the world of a woman who, to put things lightly, is not happy with her life. Lightly indeed. For a full 55 minutes of Hard Truth's 97-minute running time, Pansy, the character played by British actress Marianne Jean-Baptiste, strikes out in every direction, at anyone and everyone, from a hapless grocery store clerk to her own husband and son. Leigh eventually gives us clues as to what is causing Pansy's unhappiness, but true to his intentions, which are replete throughout his 50-plus year career, they prove to be neither an excuse nor a necessary route to a happy ending. As in such past films as 1996's Secrets and Lies and 2008's Happy-Go-Lucky, what Leigh is most interested in is the individual's attempts to persevere in what so often is an uncaring universe, and his way of dealing with actors, which often involves workshopping his films through improvisation, affords his cast a lot of freedom to form their characters, likable or not.
Dan, as you indicated, we can begin our discussion of Hard Truths by talking about how it's a hard watch. I mean, this film is tough to watch for almost the first hour. And that's because our lead character, Pansy, is just so unlikable. We cannot wrap our minds around what's going on, because you said she lashes out at everyone. But she lashes out at them in a way that, in true Mike Leigh fashion, is part horrifying and part risible. So you do have to laugh at some of the things she says, because she's not wrong. It's just the way in which she presents everything. And she doesn't have a positive word to say to anyone. And her husband, who appears to be long-suffering, although later we find out maybe not so much, and her son, who seems to be on the autism spectrum, is not meeting her expectations. No one meets her expectations. Most important, she does not meet her own expectations. And so that's part of what's happening here. But I think we can look at this film three different ways, like the typical sort of Mike Leigh, tough, hardscrabble people that he tends to focus on. And some of his earlier characters have been notably unlikable. I think in particular, David Thewlis, which is the first time I remember seeing him in Naked back in the day. And he has a similar persona to Pansy, except he's more of an evil person. And he also is prone to engage in self-aggrandizement and endless philosophizing in a way that she does not.
And how about Eddie Marsan in Happy-Go-Lucky, the counterfoil to Sally Hawkins.
Or Secrets and Lies, as you mentioned as well. I mean, you know, we have multiple characters in that particular performance who are tough to deal with. Or we think of even the subject matter of something such as Vera Drake, which was very morose. Imelda Staunton starred in that. So we have the story, and Mike Leigh does tend to focus on these characters in working class Britain, and this is no exception.
What's notable is that they're all black in this particular case.
Right. And so what is particularly appealing about this is the fact that we have Pansy, who seems to be mad at the world in Hard Truths. And then we have her sister, Chantal, who does seem to be the happy-go-lucky character. She's a hairstylist. She has these two cool daughters who are Pansy's nieces. And the sort of conceit around which this plot operates is it's going to be the fifth anniversary of their mother's death, and Chantal wants Pansy to go with her to the cemetery to sort of say goodbye, make amends, you know, engage in some sort of memorial service. And Pansy is loath to get involved in that in any way. But how would you describe sitting through the first hour of this? Because you have to really gird your loins. because there's not a nice word or a nice thing that happens to or with Pansy.
And certainly having worked in, say, customer service positions or any kind of service position,
there's a great scene in a furniture store.
A pansy, and so your whole body kind of tenses up if you've ever had to interact with somebody like that, especially if you have to be, you know, cool and collected and professional around them and they are not giving it back to you. You keep talking about Hard Truths, about the first hour being particularly grueling, and it is because Pansy is just screaming and shouting and steamrolling over everybody.
Spewing vitriol in every direction.
She's clearly in pain.
It. Yes, yeah. But about an hour in, the moment that you're sort of alluding to is when she's talking with her sister, who's played by Michelle Austin, who I think is terrific.
Yeah, she's been in other Michael.
Yeah, right. And she just says to Pansy, "Why are you angry all the time?" And that's the moment when the movie does change. The entire tenor and tempo of the movie and, to a certain degree, of the character of Pansy changes. And that kind of sleight of hand is what I love so much about Mike Lee, because his style is so unassuming and his stories and his milieus are always so mundane. As you mentioned, it's often British working class people, that the emotional weight of those stories sometimes sneaks up on you, where you're sitting there going, where exactly is this going? And then you figure it out and you have that aha moment. And he also loves, as you mentioned, to really test our patience with his characters.
No kidding.
You mentioned some of the others, David Thewlis and Sally Hawkins. And
how about Timothy Spall and Mr. Turner?
Sure. I was thinking of Jane Horrocks in Life is Sweet, Leslie Manville in Another Year, and to a degree, Brenda Blethyn in Secrets and Lies. All of those characters, the way that they're performed, the way that they're written, you think these are just screeching stereotypes or caricatures. Like, am I going to be able to spend any time with them and not go crazy? And then Lee always manages to pull the rug out from under you and make you realize that this person has a humanity that you hadn't seen before, and that all of their tics and quirks are defense mechanisms, or they're covering up for something else. And certainly that happens with Pansy.
But he doesn't make any excuses for them either.
Absolutely not. He doesn't even necessarily ask you to sympathize or empathize with them. And it's kind of up to you about how much you want to do that. And I just want to say that Marianne Jean-Baptiste's performance in this movie, Hard Truths, is one of the best performances I've seen in I don't know how long. I know the Oscars are, we talk about them all the time, but they're kind of dumb. This is the biggest Oscar oversight of the year as far as I'm concerned. Very few actors are willing to go out on a limb as long as she does, are willing to play a character who is so hateful for so long. And the fact that there was a moment in this movie where I actually started crying is a testament to her performance, because for the first hour I thought, this woman is... I mean, she's
insufferable.
Awful. And I agree that you do sort of have to laugh a little bit because it's so over the top. Yeah. You're like, is there anything this woman can't complain about? And he doesn't quite get into the specifics of why she behaves like that, but you have a pretty good idea. And so, yeah, I think this movie is fantastic. I love Mike Lee. I think he is one of the greatest filmmakers Evs. And if we had seen this in 2024, this would have been high up on my top 10 list. I thought it was great.
Can you imagine what it would be like to be a cast member and working with this? Because he does workshop these.
Yeah.
I mean, he comes out with basic ideas and then says, okay, here's the scene, and then just lets
these
actors...
And then the actors kind of figure out where the story's going to go, who the characters are going to be.
We should point out that the husband is played by David Weber, Kirtley, and then the son is played by Tewayne Barrett. And both those put in downbeat but affecting performances.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's this moment where you kind of start to realize what the dynamic between the husband and wife is, where she's just regaling him with all of these grievances and he just kind of stares off into space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just wonder, how does he live with this? There's also this detail of Pansy cleaning all the time. She's constantly cleaning her house to the point that it looks like they just moved into one of those model homes.
Yes.
Right.
There are no features to it. It's so beige.
Nothing personal.
Nothing personal. And I think that also is a little clue as to maybe what's happening here.
Well, and the good news is occasionally there are moments of levity. I love the nieces.
Yes.
I thought that they were a really nice addition to changing the tempo of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that's fascinating about this is the reaction of the people who Pansy focuses her ire on these particular people. They're just, you mentioned customer services, and that seems to be at least part of it. Mm-hmm. But people are just dumbfounded. They're like gobsmacked. Like, what's going on here?
What did I do to set this off? And I think it's a key to Mike Lee's empathy as a filmmaker that he shows us the lives of all these supporting characters. I think other filmmakers would have just focused on Pansy, but he creates this cast around her.
That's right, and would have offered us some sort of palliative at the end. I was watching a small video of Terry Gilliam, and Gilliam was talking about the difference between Steven Spielberg and Stanley Kubrick. And he was saying, you know, look at Schindler's List. He says, you know, what we have there at the very end is, ooh, this man saved a few lives. That's not what the story was. Kubrick would have said, no, 6 million people died. There's the story.
Well, I think both of those stories can be true.
Exactly.
And that's what makes
them
great filmmakers.
So, but all I'm saying is that Lee is more in the Kubrick camp than in the Spielberg camp.
And I have to say the title is.
I don't know. I might push back on that, but that's a discussion for another day.
And I think the title is perfect.
Absolutely. Hard truths. No wonder that audiences weren't flocking to see this because it sounds like it's going to be homework. And maybe for some people it will be. But yeah, I love Mike Lee. I think this is one of the best movies he's ever made.
For therapists, it might be homework for sure.
And that was our discussion of Hard Truths. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts at Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Steven Soderbergh's Presence and Mohammad Rosoloff's The Seed of the Sacred Fig. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Mike Lee's film Hard Truths. The next two films that we'll be tackling are Steven Soderbergh's Presence and Iranian filmmaker Mohammad Rosoloff's The Seed of the Sacred Fig. Let's begin by heading for a suburban house that holds a mysterious, well, presence. From his breakthrough film, 1989 Sex, Lies, and Videotape, through his Oscar-winning turn with 2000's Traffic and his Oceans trilogy, among others, Steven Soderbergh has made movies that range from the pure artistic to the mainstream popular. Whatever project he chooses to take on, though, Soderbergh brings to it a sure sense that someone with intelligence and taste is sitting behind the camera. That's true of Presence, a story about a family's buying a new home and having then to deal with an unseen entity whose tie to the family only eventually becomes, well, somewhat clear. The screenplay by veteran David Koepp doesn't offer anything new, and in the hands of a less talented director, Presence might be nothing more than a standard horror feature. But as he tends to do, Soderbergh offers something a bit different, including a point-of-view filming technique that makes those of us watching a virtual partner in the storytelling.
Yeah, it's almost like we are the ghost that is haunting this house, and because we're only seeing things through, well, the disembodied eyes of this presence. We're never in the head of the thing, whatever it may be. And so it's that subjective camera. And we talked about this just recently with Nickel Boys, which used a similar kind of first-person POV. So it's interesting that both of those are playing in theaters at the same time. And I kind of loved the first half of Presence, and it reminded me of, and we talked about this a little bit off mic, it reminded me of David Lowery's film A Ghost Story, which also centered a ghost who in that instance looked like, you know, one of those traditional Halloween sheet over your head with the holes, the eye holes cut in it.
Which could have been absolutely hilarious in the wrong hands.
But man, that movie is so sad and poetic and beautiful. And it just kind of follows this ghost as he haunts a house and the world moves around him and he is stuck there. And there is sort of a feeling of that malaise in Presence. And I liked the idea of observing this family, and we start to see the kind of fractures that are there from the very beginning.
Yep.
I liked the idea of examining that from without. You know, the movie's almost hovering above them, sometimes literally.
And it doesn't give you everything.
You know, we're trying to piece it together based on what we see. I don't know if Soderbergh quite pushes the possibilities of that subjective camera as far as it can go. Early on, there are some moments where he uses that technique to subvert what we expect from a haunted house movie, and it's kind of thrilling. Unfortunately, this screenplay by David Koepp, who's written lots of good movies and lots of bad
some
movies.
Other ones.
Yeah, I think the screenplay is too focused on resolving its own plot, which kind of becomes more concrete as it goes. And I'm sorry,
and he gives it away two-thirds of the way through.
And I thought the last third of this movie was unbelievably stupid. I mean, once I started to figure out this is the plot line that we're following to its logical conclusion, it was so absurd to me. I mean, maybe absurd is the wrong word. It just didn't work for me that the ultimate sort of punchline on the story or the thing that sends you out of the theater didn't have the emotional punch that I think it was supposed to have. So I admired the technique here, but it does feel like some of his other recent films feels like he had a fully baked gimmick or hook and not a fully baked script here.
Well, and let's also look at some other aspects of this film. So if we're looking at presence, I mean, I love the long takes of the ghost when we were following the ghost around.
And from the very moments, early moments in the movie.
And knowing it's Steven Soderbergh behind the
camera
adds an element here of,
So there's that. The other thing is, things happen that are never truly explained. So, for example, you expect Julia Fox, who makes a cameo, you know, as this real estate agent, I thought she'd show back up again, you know, because she's known or well-known or infamous, I don't know. So she never comes back. Then the pairing of Lucy Liu with Chris Sullivan, who some people might remember as Toby in This Is Us.
Which I called the crying show.
Right. Seemed really sort of odd, to say the least. And then we have this psychic who appears in presence. So she introduces what we know is going to be the ultimate outcome in some particular way.
It's that classic scene from Poltergeist or Paranormal Activity, you know, the medium explaining, you know.
But then kind of there's the fact that obviously Lucy Liu's character, so she's the mom, she dotes on her son. And at one point, she starts to talk about something that's happening at work, and it's never fully explained, but we get the impression that she's either pulling a scam or she's embezzling money or she's involved in some sort of financial shenanigans or whatever at her workplace. So there's all this stuff that happens that sort of goes nowhere or is left open-ended.
But that's but I think that's to the strength of the film
because
it's the subjective viewpoint that we never really know what's really going on in people's
lives. And then sorry, guys, did not really know what happened at the end. So I guess for some of us, it wasn't as obvious as others might have thought.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I think that there's a lot to think about in terms of the movie presence, and that was our discussion. Let's now turn to a film from Iran, The Seed of the Sacred Fig. It's clear by now that making movies in Iran is no easy feat, especially when the movies are in any way critical of the country's government. A jail sentence is likely to ensue, and time in prison is what faced Mohammad Rasoulov even before the premiere of his film at the Cannes Film Festival. Based on his previous work, Iran's Revolutionary Court had sentenced him to 8 years in prison, to which he responded by trekking over Iran's mountains on a quest that eventually landed him in Germany. Imagine what kind of a sentence The Seed of the Sacred Fig might earn him, a film that features a character played by Misag Gzare, who, promoted to a job as government investigator, is pressured to do his prosecutor's bidding regardless of the truth. Over time, we see him begin to crumble, taking his rage out on his family, on his rebellious children, but also on his loyal wife, played by Soheila Golestani. Rasoulov's film is a powerful statement about the dangers of unchecked authoritarian power, which is something that those of us living in the U.S. are, at this very moment, in the process of learning.
We've seen other Iranian films that are more allegorical in terms of their criticism, but these were not films that were made behind closed doors. They were also not films that featured actual footage that had been filmed by citizen journalists on their iPhones during various protests and revolutions in this country. And so this is more stark and overt in terms of maybe because it's made behind closed doors and people affiliated with the film had to flee to Europe rather than risk censure and arrest and so forth. But in The Seed of the Sacred Fig, we see this intergenerational conflict. We see this familial conflict that all sort of represents how people are trying to navigate what becomes the new normal, so to speak. And there are some twists and turns here that I won't get into, but the dad thinks that he's like doing a good thing, that he's doing a righteous thing, because mom and dad are ultimately willing to give it up, not for the government, but for God. And they feel as though God would not have placed him in this position if he weren't supposed to be there or something along those lines. The older daughter, her best friend, is horribly beaten at this particular protest and demonstration, and that segues into a conversation with her parents about what's happening in the streets and, you know, pull your head out of the sand and so forth and so on.
And it's at that point that Russeloff adds in actual archival footage of,
yes,
of the news,
yes,
reports
which
of actual
I thought,
protests
which
in Iran.
I thought was definitely effective. The beginning of the movie takes place almost entirely behind closed doors and in this apartment because there's concern that the judge might be targeted, the family might be targeted. And then all of a sudden it opens up and turns into a completely different movie,
yeah,
which I was like, whoa, yeah, didn't really expect that.
Yeah, and just during the last, I don't know, hour of this movie, because this movie is long. It's, you know, 2 hours, 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The last hour, I felt like I was just leaning closer and closer to the screen because I was so on edge and didn't know what was going to happen, because you just know that all of this tension is going to explode because the differences within this family begin as ideological, and then they become something much different.
It's so funny. I just thought of The Shining with the Jack Nicholson,
oh, sure,
character.
There
at first being one thing and then, whoa, turning into somebody
and,
completely
and
else.
And I think even though you're right about the seed of the sacred fig being less allegorical than, say, something like Children of Heaven,
yeah,
another Iranian film classic, I do think there is an allegorical streak to the representation of the handgun in this movie, what the handgun that eventually goes missing, what it represents. And then the final scenes, without giving anything away, I think there is a lot of metaphor and symbolism.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
But beyond everything else, this is just an incredibly tense political thriller, family drama. I also think, along with Hard Truths, this would have been on my top 10 list for 2024.
I agree.
I think this movie's pretty sensational.
Yeah, and that's saying something, because some of the best films that I've seen in the last 30 years,
yeah,
have come out of Iran.
And this,
the circle,
add this to the list.
You know,
A Separation.
The White Balloon.
Yep, yep.
Yes.
Jafar,
oh,
Panahi.
Absolutely.
Yeah, add this to the list. This is definitely worth,
absolutely,
checking out.
Well, that was our discussion of the Iranian film, The Seed of the Sacred Fig. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbind and Murray Pat Truthart and I discussed Mike Leigh's Hard Truths and Steven Soderbergh's Presence. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late, great Billy Wilder. Shoot a few scenes out of focus. I want to win the Foreign Film Award. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.